I'm Bernard Smythe, a retired journalist. I got into the business when I came out of the Navy after National Service. My father sent me an advert for a local guy in Slough, wanted on the local paper to become a reporter. My father thought that because I could write a good letter, perhaps I could write a story.
So you're not the only person in your family in the business, are you?
No, I've got two brothers who are in the business as well. My father was a technical author, so words run in the family, I suppose. And we're of Irish extraction, so we have a way with words, I suppose, I hope.
So what was your first, if you just describe your first couple of days at work?
Well, I actually started on the Slough Express, which was a part of the Windsor Slough and Eton Express group. It's a bit of a shock because you find you have to go out and interview people, and you get shown around the first couple of days by somebody, but then you're quickly on your own and knocking on doors and quizzing people, which was quite strange to me because I'd just had 2 years in the Royal Navy and had learnt Russian and was not in the way of interviewing people. It was a totally different life.
So how did you get on with it?
Oh, I enjoyed it. There were some great guys I worked with, and I fell foul of the editor. I think he found out my father was a Labour agent, and he didn't realise this when he took me on. So I ended up going round the corner to the Slough Observer, which was a good move in a way because it was a much better paper, I think. And it produced a whole flock of really good people who went on to Fleet Street and did well.
So that sounds a bit strange because why should it matter what your father is, whether or not you're employed on a newspaper or not?
Well, they were very conservative, and I just had this feeling that they picked a fight with me because of my father. Whereas my father was friends with the editor of the Slough Observer, and he welcomed me with open arms. So,
you say the Observer was a better paper. Why was that?
It had a very good news editor, and the editor was the owner, and he didn't interfere in the production at all. He's a very simple sort of man, who good businessman, but he left the news editor to get on with it, and he was an excellent guy who died about a year ago. But he was very good at training people. You know, I literally went round the villages on my dad's bike, getting the news from the local vicar and WI and so on, and I always said that if you came back without somebody's age, the news editor would send you back on your bike down out several miles to go and find out how old this person was, and that's good training. You know, you don't forget the next time.
But things have moved on a lot since the idea of sort of cycling around. That almost sounds comical today. The journalists chasing stories on bicycles. Was it like that for a long time, or did it change quite quickly?
Oh yes, it changed after about a year or so. I bought a Vespa scooter and chased this around the villages on that instead of a bike. But I mean, it's good training. You get to know people. You dig out stories from the local postmaster, the vicar, and so on, you know, teachers and all sorts of people you meet. You know, a very broad spectrum of people. Find out what's going on, and a lot of it was quite small stuff, you know, about flower shows and kids' achievements and so on. But it's good training, and it's good to meet all these different people.
So were you in the union in those early days?
Oh, yes. I was recruited straight away, really, on the Observer, and I've been in it ever since, really, except for 3 years in Australia when I was in the AJA, the Australian Journalists Association.
Do you think, right, even in those early days, the union had played a part in your career?
Oh no, I don't think so. In those early days, I don't think it did to a great extent. Anyway, you know, at various times I was a branch secretary or part of the leadership at the Evening Post in Bristol, but. I don't think it affected my career or enhanced my career, if that's what you mean. Yeah.
Well, so it had more to do with your work when you were here in Bristol then, did it? Is that what you're saying?
Not with my work. I mean, the two things are separate, really. I mean, okay, you're fighting for better conditions or better pay, but the work is totally separate from the union, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Tell us about your move to Bristol and what it was like when you were over here.
I came to Bristol as a reporter after about 3 years of training in Slough, and because there was this progression from weekly paper, which the Slabs ever is, to an evening paper, and then on into Fleet Street, if you can. But I came to the Evening World, which doesn't exist anymore. It merged into the Evening Post in Bristol about 1960-61. That was an interesting paper. Again, it was a good training ground with a good news editor. But after about a year, I felt I'd had enough of knocking on doors and asking about dead children and so on, and I decided I'd prefer to be a sub-editor. And a mate of mine who was a good sub said the only thing to do was to get a job anywhere as a sub. And then, after about a year or so, you can call yourself a sub and go and get a better job. So I went to the Western Daily Press, which was dying on its feet in Bristol, and it was only just across the road, really, but it was in a bad way, down to about 13,000 circulation, and really struggling. But it was a good training, because we shifted an awful lot of words, and I started to learn about writing headlines and editing stuff down and so on.
So what was it like in the 1950s then? And because there were there's the Evening World and the Evening Post as two separate papers in Bristol. There's actually not many people maybe in Bristol can remember those days.
No, it's true. I think the Post actually owned the Evening World latterly. But it had a strange policy in that it wouldn't let the Evening World sell in Bristol. It was very restricted circulation, so it sold mainly in the country areas. And the Western Daily Press was then a separate entity, but while I was there, it was bought up by the Post, so that the Post owned all three papers. And eventually we moved over from Baldwin Street to Silver Street, which was the headquarters of the Post. And a guy called Eric Price came along from the Daily Express in London to be editor and to shake the place by the throat. And gradually the circulation went up, and he saved the paper, really.
So there, these various different places in Bristol. Now, the Evening Post and Western Daily Press are based at Temple Way. Whereabouts did the old papers used to be? You mentioned Silver Street.
Yeah, for many years, Silver Street, the old fire station in Bristol, was the headquarters and printing place for the Evening Post. When I joined the Western Daily Press, it was in Baldwin Street. It's now an insurance office. Well, it's been rebuilt, but the site is an insurance office. But gradually, the Post, after I left Bristol, the Post closed down the Evening World. And then they just produced the Post and Press in Silver Street until about 1974. They all moved over to Temple Way.
So what was the actual working conditions like? Did you see them change much over the years, you know, either side of these different editors and mergers?
Yes, the Evening World was a strange newsroom. It had a one big long room with a sheltered part, a sort of a glass house at the on the end where the subs sat. But the reporter's room was just a big room with a great big butcher's table, deal table, in the middle of the room, with one swan neck telephone for use by the reporters. So we used to go out into a... It was designed as a newspaper office by Northcliffe, but out in the sort of outer parts of this office, there were telephone reporters stations. So we used to go out there and use those telephones. But it was a strange business to have one swan neck phone in the middle of this deal table.
Did you used to have to queue up to use it?
Yes, yeah. Or you go out into this other outer room where you could put these headphones on and ring up people from there.
Was it at the same site that the paper was printed?
Yes, the presses were down below. But in those days, I had moved on from a bike and a scooter to going places by bus in Bristol. And you did a lot of going out on buses, you know, you... learnt the city very quickly, and also you'd get shifted sometimes to go out and report on a size course, say down in Wells. So you had this nice day out sitting on the top of a bus going down to Wells to report on some case, and then a bus ride back again.
Can you tell us about some of the memorable stories you either covered or wrote up as a sub, some maybe memorable headlines, stuff that sticks in your mind?
When I left Bristol, I went to work in Birmingham for a while, and I was there when the first man in space was launched, and that was, I handled that story. That was probably the biggest story I'd ever handled up till then. So much of what is in local papers is a bit samey, I suppose, is a word. It all sort of goes by in a blur in the end.
Okay, so what about as a sub? Did you feel happier?
Oh, I felt much happier as a sub, yeah. I'd had enough of knocking on doors and was much happier handling other people's stuff. So, and it's quite an art, and I enjoyed doing it. Spent the rest of my life really editing and enjoyed it.
What about the changes in the technology that you've seen over the years?
That's been amazing. I started out with pen and ink and or pencil and paper, and stuff was all set in hot metal. As a sub, you gain the technique of being able to read type upside down, back to front, and because you stood one side of the form, whereas the compositor was the other side, and you learnt this technique of reading stuff in this weird manner. But I was very lucky in that the changes came along with the new technology, and I managed to scramble onto that bandwagon by the skin of my teeth, really. For a while in Bristol, I joined the Central Office of Information as a press officer. And there was a young guy there who was very interested in computers and persuaded the boss to buy a little word processing machine, an Amstrad. And this was my first real introduction to computers. And this thing was so successful amongst the staff that within no time we had two of these machines. And then I went off to London to work in the Home Office as managing editor. And we had two PCs between three of us, me and the two editors who worked for me. And gradually, you saw these changes coming along, and the two computers disappeared and the whole place was wired up. And before you knew it, there was one PC per desk, and they were all... linked up so that you could email each other and so on. And within, say, two or three years, that whole lot went and a whole new lot of computers came in, and it was quite an eye-opener.
But And what about before that? Because very few people now actually know what how the work the job was done. I mean, obviously now it's all kind of desktop publishing and computer files, which are used to create the type. You mentioned something called the form. I mean, you know, very few people now actually know what that was. So can you just describe the process and what it was like? Because it involved you as a sub and a printer.
A compositor, yeah. It was... we still wrote stories out or typed stories out on bits of copy paper, which were cut out of the ends of reels of newspaper. And we would send the stuff down in a chute to the composing room where it would be set on linotype machines, which set one line at a time. And this lot was put together in eventually into what's called a form, which was a big steel case, which was the same size as two pages of a newspaper. And there wasn't time to make ink impressions or paper impressions of these pages. So if you're in a hurry on an evening paper, this is where reading the type in the form, which is left, you know, it's printed, it's the wrong way around. So that when it's printed on paper, it's the right way around. So you learn this technique of reading the stuff the wrong way around. And you stood at one side of the, there was this union division where you were a journalist. This side of the these forms were on wheeled trolleys, so they could be moved about and impressions taken from the from this type, and the other side of the form, this trolley, was a compositor who was putting the stuff in the page, and he's relying on you to, if it was too long, to cut it in, and they were very skilled guys, and the trick was to be friends with them and get on with them. And I was quite happy to do that because I got respect for people who got skills.
So how did it work? Was there sort of the NUJ working with the printing union? Is it the NGA or something? I'm not absolutely sure what those unions were in those days.
Yes, it was the National Graphical Association, the NGA. We didn't work closely in the sense of union members. In fact, there was there was an occasion where really the unions fell out because the printers weren't prepared to back the journalists. So I suppose they felt that the journalists wouldn't back them, and when it came to Wapping and the changes there, they were proved to be right.
Well, that's interesting that the printers wouldn't back the journalists. What was that issue?
That was over pay and... In the Evening Post, 1979, the journalists were really badly paid, and we had a 6-7 week strike, and the printers weren't supportive.
But you have been involved in the NUJ. Can you tell us in what capacity, in what years, and what branches?
Oh, I've forgotten the years, but I was in Bristol. I was branch secretary at one point, and. At the Evening Post, I was a member of the committee around the time of the strike in 79. But during the strike, I got this job at the Central Office of Information, so I went off to, with my goods, all my belongings, sent out from the office. They wouldn't even allow me in the office during the strike. They sent all my belongings out in a cardboard box.
So... what was it actually like? I mean, how many people were working there when you had to go out on strike, roughly?
Oh, I forget the numbers.
Can you just give us a bit of background to that dispute? Because I think many people listening today will think, crikey, you know, full-on strike at the Evening Post is almost unthinkable now.
Well, there was... The journalists were really badly paid, and they slipped well behind, and... it seems strange, but they were, for once in their lives, they were actually angry and prepared to do something about it. And and this wasn't just the Evening Post. This was regional papers throughout the country. And the NUJ nationally called this strike, and it was backed by a lot of people who surprised themselves, I think.
But at that point, you went into working in public relations. Did you stay there, or did you come back into journalism?
I went off from... Well, there's a big gap here. I last mentioned Birmingham, where I stayed only about 10 months, because I was sort of headhunted to go to London to work on the Daily Sketch as a sub. And before long, I was working on the Daily Mirror, which was then quite a... I think a very good paper.
Why do you say that? Why was the Daily Mirror a good paper?
Well, it tackled all sorts of issues which newspapers seem to have given up on, most of them. It would actually tackle issues of the day, and it had a couple of pages called The World Spotlight, which had news from every corner of the world. It was quite a serious paper in its own way, and I was quite proud to work for it. And
did you get to know some of the characters there, editors and people like that?
Well, I was a sub-editor, but you work to chief sub-editors and night editors. The editor would appear in the office once an evening, perhaps. And you certainly didn't meet bosses, you know, owners and directors and people.
Okay, so I mean, that sounds like must have been an interesting and exciting time. What was it, do you think, that made you feel that was, you know, such a satisfying job to do there, and how did it end?
Well, I was headhunted. I did enjoy the work there very much. I mean, the strange thing was, talking about technology, at the Daily Mirror, we wrote every story out by hand. We would be given reams of paperwork, you know, it'd be stories from local correspondents, there'd be press association copy, local freelancers copy. We would be given all this stuff, and we'd have to read it all and distill it into, you know, maybe at the most 15 paragraphs. And every word of that we'd write out by hand, which would be taken down, maybe if it was late, bit at a time, sent down to the composing room to be set into hot metal again.
You've described what the newsroom at the Evening World was like. What was the Mirror like?
Well, when I went to the Mirror, it was in an almost new building, which has now been knocked down. But it was a high-tech sort of big open-plan newsroom with subs and reporters in separate sections, but all in one big open plan office. And there was a good atmosphere there that you felt. I was feeling happy to be there because you were with some very good sub editors, and I enjoyed the sort of atmosphere there.
Can you tell us about your relationship with the union, and whether you feel that it's a worthwhile thing to do to join a union?
Oh, I'm definitely in favour of people joining unions. The bottom line is that you need to be organised together to look after yourselves, because nobody else would do it. It's good when people, like during that strike in Bristol, people come together and they appreciate each other.
But you see, the proprietors would say, wouldn't they, that the unions just interfere with the running of the newspaper.
Well, the journalists are really interested in getting the paper out. They're not interested in stopping work, but if they are badly treated enough, they will get on their hind legs and do something about it, eventually.
How about for a youngster coming into the profession then? What advice would you have to them after your years of working as a journalist?
The job seems to me to have changed quite a lot. I see people sitting, or I have seen people sitting at computers all day, and not sub-editors, I mean reporters. And this seems strange to me because I think they should be getting out there, talking to people and meeting people in pubs and knocking on doors, getting stories, not spending all their day looking at the internet. There are stories on the internet, I agree, but I think a lot of the digging around and trying to expose wrongs, a lot of that has gone out the window.
But what advice? Okay, well, what advice would you have for a youngster coming into the profession? Would you think that you'd say just don't spend so much time in the office? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not in their hands, really. I mean, they're given the job by the news editor, and if they're told to sit and surf the internet all day, they have to do that. But I would prefer the youngsters to get out and meet people. Because I don't think you get stories in the office. You get stories out on the street.
Do you think that the way we do news nowadays has become more of a sort of ivory tower, with journalists having quite a lot of distance between themselves and the community?
I think that's a danger. Yes, I take the Evening Post now. I don't see lots of investigative work going on there, and there must be stories to be told in Bristol, which we're probably not being told.